America starts the day with America in the Morning.
The first of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wall.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
This is a big one. This is, the last 2 days here, we've had some brilliant guests. It's Supernatural Week, and it's been fun. Have you guys had fun? I've had so much fun talking to these gentlemen. They've been on this show since most of you were like 4 years old, and now it's ending. It's the final season. Holy shit. Thank you again for listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Subscribe, write a review, tell your friends, whatever you're doing it right. Tom Welling and I will be signing October 18th in Columbus, Madison, Wisconsin on the 25th, November 8th in Austin. Then my band goes to Germany, Left on Laurel, our debut album. I mean, how many albums do you get in your lifetime? I never thought I'd make an album. This is my problem, my only album. Today is the day it comes out on all platforms. So either buy it on iTunes or listen to the hell out of it. Also, you can go to the Inside of You store and you could purchase vinyls, the hats, stickers, shirts. We're really excited. And at the end of this episode, we're going to play track 4 for you from the debut album, Saved by the Ground. And Jensen really liked this album. Mm-hmm. That's the word on the street. So right now, Jensen Ackles, I don't think I need that. You know, Dean Winchester. I mean, he was on Smallville. He was actually Kristen Kreuk, who was Lana. He was her football coach, which was weird because he was like the same age as Tom Welling. And he's in a high school football coach dating Lana. The times have changed, folks. But then he got his own show. Final season of Supernatural. Final guest of the week. Dean Winchester himself. Jensen Ackles. I love this man. I've known him for a long time. I love seeing his success. Let's get inside Jensen.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You. Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Jensen Ackles, dude!
Rosie, man. How long's it been?
It's been, I don't know when the last time I've seen you. I can't remember.
Did we not run into each other in Vancouver when you were up there doing,
Impastor. Yeah. My Impastor lasted 13 less seasons than Supernatural.
Right.
we got done with two.
You know what? Again, there it is. You got in, you got out.
We got it. Yeah, it's like that. Exactly. Hey, it's the old Ackles.
I don't know when to leave. That's the problem. I've overstayed my welcome.
But you know when to leave now. This is it.
Well.
What do you mean, well?
Let's hope so. Let's hope this was the, it was a gamble either way. It was a gamble to continue on. It was a gamble to call it quits. So,
wait a minute. Are you right now saying on Inside of You that there is a small remote possibility that Supernatural might even think about another year after this year that they've decided to end the show? Are you giving a morsel of hope? Just a morsel. Like, are you giving like a fragment, like, Andre the Giant's penis compared to my penis, like a small.
I'm nervous to go into that comparison. Sure. I mean, look, I don't know. I love the show. I mean, I've gone this long. Why wouldn't we just keep going? But at the same time, it's, you know, and this isn't just coming from me. This is a laundry list of people that have had this conversation and are continuing to have this conversation. But it was one of these things where, you know, let's decide before it's too late. Let's decide before it gets decided for us. And I think that's where a lot of us wanted to reside, was we made the call. It was, you know, we wanted to be a little bit like Elway, you know, go out while we're still going strong.
Right.
And I didn't, you know, and at this point now, I think that the ship has sailed, the code has been written for you youngsters out there. And I don't know that that's, you know, I don't know that we can change
Hang
that
on
now.
A second. So you're saying like, well, let's say, how many episodes do you do a year now? 18?
We were 23 for most of the series, and we just dialed it back to 20 last season, and we're going to do 20 again this season.
All right, so let's say episode 15, you're like, dude, we've got the highest ratings we've ever had in our lives. The ratings just shot up because it's the final season. And the storyline's the best storyline we've ever had. And, oh, my God, you know what could happen? I know at the very end that Misha dies. His character dies or whatever. And, but what if we did, and then one of you guys come up with the most insane idea that goes, we got to do one more. That could happen.
I would be in the other camp. You're damn right. We nailed it. We knocked it out of the park. Let's go off into the sunset.
You would.
I would be more upset if it wasn't that.
So you'd say, God, it really sucked this last year. Let's go one more.
Yeah. Wow. That I would be. Yeah. That's when I would be like, guys, we might want to think about another season.
Dude.
We really screwed the. I mean, this is not good. This isn't what we wanted to. This isn't how we wanted to end.
Well, look, man. I remember. I've known you for a long time. I remember.
Didn't it like Montana? Didn't he go to like Kansas City? And
who remembers that though? Yes, he did go to. Joe Montana went to Kansas City.
Yeah, Montana went to Kansas City. It was like, why?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
But. No one remembers Kansas City. They just remember the glory days with the 49ers.
Jordan and the Wizards, too.
Yeah, nobody remembers
Kansas
City.
Yeah, but you know what? I remember Kansas City.
Do you remember Kansas City? You don't want people to remember your Kansas. You don't yeah.
I don't want to go out Kansas City style.
That should be the last episode. It should be called Kansas City.
I want to go out Lawrence, Kansas style.
Lawrence, Kansas style. Home of like
see, that's a little tip of the hat to the show, which you may or may not
yeah,
know.
Yeah, I knew what you're talking about.
Based, so
yeah.
We don't need to go to the big city.
We've known each other for a long time. Like, I've known you for probably since, what, around 2000, 2002?
Well, yeah, yeah. That was probably right around the time. I mean, let's see. I came on Smallville at, like, it was like 03.
And let me get this straight. You played Kristen Krug's boyfriend, and you were also a high school gym teacher.
Yes.
Where was the Me Too myth then? That
right?
Shit wasn't a flu.
Oh, no way.
Right?
My favorite part about that whole situation was I was the coach of I was a coach on the football team of which Clark was quarterback. Yet I'm actually younger than Welling in real life. And somehow, somehow that didn't matter to the producers at all. And when they called me in, they're like, we've got an idea that we want to pitch you and bring you on the show. And I was like, you want me to play the football coach? In what capacity? And they're like, well, let him put it, you're going to play Kristen Crook's boyfriend. I'm like, whatever you want me to play, that's fine. If you want me to be the football coach or the janitor, Kristen's boyfriend, I'm in.
And you were on the show for 2-3 years? 5 years?
One, dude. One.
It felt like you were more seasons.
Well, that's just because I left a lasting impression. I was one season.
Because I remember you and I nude in a scene, like hung up in some, like, with our shirts off or unbuttoned, hanging up, being tortured.
No, that was when we went and played racquetball that one afternoon.
No. There's an episode where we're like, our hands are tied up.
And
we're
yes.
And racquetball. I remember that. Yeah, and I also remember, I believe I killed you.
You did.
Didn't I kill you? Didn't I throw you off a mountain or shoot you or something?
Yeah. Well, no, I was in the house. I was in the Kent house, I think, when it all crumbled to the ground, and I was in that explosion.
And were they already talking to you about Supernatural at that point?
Yeah, because I had a 2-year deal with Smallville, and so I was supposed to come back and do the next season. So they had to ride a death for me quickly because the network yanked me off of that show and had me ready for Supernatural. For the next season. So season one was season 5 of you guys.
And you tested. You went and tested for Supernatural, of course, at that point, right? You weren't a huge star then.
Well, it moved quick because Nutter was the director.
Right. Who,
and Nutter, yeah. Nutter knew me from, you know, Dark Angel and Smallville. And so he was like, this is your guy to Kripke who created it. And then Jared, they pulled him off of Gilmore Girls. So they, it was a very in-house operation. Jen Alari, who was running the network at the time, he knew both of us. He was more than happy to sign off on both of us. Peter Roth knew both of us at the time. He was more than happy to sign off on us. So we the testing process went basically like this. We read once for Eric and David. I did. And so did Jared. The next time I auditioned was the full network studio test with Jared and nobody else. No other actors were involved in the test. Usually you show up and there's like four or five other guys, you know, testing for your part. Everybody's got their contract. Nobody knows what the hell it says. We just showed up and it was just he and I. Boom. Wow. That was it.
And did you, when you read the first script, you knew Nutter was directing, right? When you saw the show, the first episode, did you go,
yeah,
we'll get a season from this? Or did you go, I don't know?
No, I immediately was like, oh, I think we got something here. But I was like, we might get a full season out of this. And then as the show started to get into it, I was like, wow, we might actually get more than one season. I mean, all the while thinking like, we could break records here and get like three full seasons before the show gets canned. But then after about midway through the first season, it was the whole merge. It was UPN WB merge. And I was like, oh, no, that's it.
We're gone.
There it is.
New guys are going to come in. We're screwed. Was it close to ever getting canceled?
Oh, we were on the bubble every year.
Every year you're on the bubble.
Every single year.
Till when?
Honestly, until
last year.
Until Pedo. Yeah. I believe we're still on the bubble right now. I'm not sure we're going to get the back nine. I think it was until Mark Pedowitz came in and he kind of assessed. I don't want to point fingers at Dawn Ostrov. I think she did great. She was given a very difficult task in marrying two networks and then trying to make shows that weren't necessarily her style of show work within her business plan. And we just weren't a show that I think she gravitated towards. We just weren't her.
This isn't our vision of where the network's going, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, she was more of the Gossip Girl, the reboot of the 90210s, it was that kind of teenage angst drama type of network that I think she was a little bit more in tune with. I mean, even you guys were a product of this a bit.
Yeah. Oh, they threw us at this night, Tuesday night. Oh, they'll fail at Tuesday. And then we killed it. So they were trying to get rid of all that stuff. And if they would have, all these other shows probably wouldn't be there. If they would have got rid of Smallville, if they would have got rid of Supernatural, then Flash, Arrow, all these other shows never would have come about probably.
I agree. I mean, we were we became a launching pad for Arrow. We became a launching pad for
When you say we, when you say we, you're saying Smallville too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you guys were our launching
kidding
pad.
Around.
You guys helped launch us. And then we were saddled up with you for quite a while, which I think you guys kind of hit multiple markets in the fact that you were the superhero, but you also were playing into that kind of teenage drama,
right,
angsty thing, which I think is what it was easier to digest for her than us. I mean, we were a horror movie every week. That's not something that she was necessarily into at the time.
Which I am. I'm into that shit.
It's so fun. It's so fun. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why we have so much fun on set is because we're not, the stuff we do is so outrageous and so ridiculous. It's fun to do. You know, you can blend this like crazy genre of horror with this action packed kind of adventurous genre. And then you also pepper in some comedy and it's like, sign me up for 15 seasons.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it evolves. I mean, from the first, the first pilot, did they have a lot of the comedy in there, or did it really sort of become funnier and darker and creepier and all these things? It just kind of evolved like every other show in a way.
Yeah, it certainly evolved. I do believe that there was a little bit more of maybe less comedy, more of that kind of devil may care attitude written for my character specifically. In fact, it's no secret that Eric originally, the creator, he said, I've based these two characters off of Luke Skywalker and Han Solo. And Han had some moments. He had some comedic relief moments in those movies. I don't necessarily think that they were in the script. I think that was just Harrison Ford being Harrison Ford and just adding that flavor. And so I kind of took that as a blueprint and then expanded on it and added a little bit more of kind of the ridiculous humor. Because I thought it was a nice balance with how deep and scary and horrific the images that you were seeing on screen could be balanced with the goofiness that we could provide.
Right. I mean, growing up, were your parents always supportive? Did you always want to be an actor? Because you were an athlete, right? You were an athlete in high school.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of walked both paths. I was doing drama and I was performing in like the annual spring plays.
Did you love it back then? Did you love acting?
I don't know if I loved it because it wasn't. I wasn't living in an environment that really nurtured that as much as it did sports. You know, I mean, growing up in Texas, like it's all about what organized sport you're a part of and how good your team is and how, you know, if you're going to get scouted by college scouts. And there's a lot of pressure. I think that's changed dramatically since I grew up here. But the arts weren't really focused on as much as sports were. And so I kind of took my, you know, lead from that and focused a little bit more on my athletics and less on the dramatics. And then ultimately I started to succeed more in the dramatics than in the athletics. And that led me to Hollywood. And then that was it.
Do you think that sports were sort of looked down, or not sports, but like you said, like with acting, was it kind of like, I grew up in Indiana. I was born in New York, but I grew up in Indiana. And, you know, I don't think theater, again, was one of those big things. Although the University of Evansville was like 10 miles away where Rami Malek went. You know, he graduated from there and he went on to do Bohemian Rhapsody. And who else was from there? I mean, there was a couple people that went on to be actors, me being one of them. But, you know, I can't say that everybody wanted to go see the play on a Friday night or Saturday. They wanted to go see sports. Like you said, did people look down and you're like, come on, man, what are you doing? Were they real hard on you? They're like, come on, man. They call you names. They call you fairy boy who wants to do theater.
Yeah. And that was, you know, that was certainly more of an acceptable behavior back then. I mean, I'm glad that the times have changed, that, you know, you'll get raked over the coals if you ostracize somebody to that degree. And,
right.
And good, you should, because there were some people that I was in theater with that really, really got bullied bad. And it was a time and it was a culture then where it was even looked at. Like, I wish that there were more opportunities where I could have stood up for that person.
Sure.
But, you know, they didn't speak out because it would just make things worse.
Sad.
And I'm glad now that people like that have a voice and that people who can fight for them. I wish I'd had a chance and an opportunity to do more of that when I was younger. But regardless, yeah, I don't think there's other folks from, it's mainly sports athletes, you know, a couple of musicians, not a lot of theater is given a whole lot of credit. Hey, what's up?
Who's that?
That's my daughter. That's JJ. Say hi, JJ.
JJ. Hey, what's going on? What are you doing? Are you going swimming?
She can't hear you. You're on the
iPhone. Then you tell her what I just said. Say, are you going swimming, baby?
He says, I don't know where your lovey is. Why don't you go find it yourself?
That's not what I said.
I'm just kidding. Is it not in the car? Okay. Well, I know it's not in here, so keep looking. Okay. No problem.
No, we're keeping that in. I think it's a nice touching moment. And by the way, when I said baby, I was saying that because I feel like you would call her baby. All right, baby.
Uh-huh.
I could feel like a little Southern accent, like you'd say baby.
Yeah. Oh, like, it's all right, my baby.
Hey, baby, I love you. I don't know where your damn swimsuit is, man.
I don't know where your lovey is.
I don't know where your lovey is. In case you get a lovey ass out of my way while daddy does an interview. You don't talk like that at all.
I don't at all.
I know. Not at all.
But anyway, where were we?
I was just talking about like being an actor and how hard it was and like it's cool.
Yeah, I'll never forget my senior year. I did the big spring. We put on a musical and it was West Side Story. And
who are you?
Actually, I played Tony.
You were Tony.
I was Tony. And I had never sung in front of an audience before in my life.
Oh, my God.
Certainly not to an audience of my peers. I remember opening night and I get out there and it's that big opening, like, could be, who knows, there's something new anyway, I will know right away, soon as it shows. It may be cannonball that never from the sky,
gleaming inside, right as a rose and bomb.
So that was I'm out there and I'm just, you know,
wailing.
And the entire, because I was on the baseball team, the entire varsity baseball team is sitting in like the first two rows. And you can't see when you're on stage. You know this. There's lights in your eyes. You can't really see past the first two rows.
Oh, I get nervous just now thinking about that.
And there they all are. And I'll never forget coming down on that proscenium by myself on the stage. First song, first time you see me come out on stage. And I'm belting it out, and I just see the faces, and they're just slack jawed, just like just staring up at me, mouth like open slightly, just like who is this person, and what have they done with our friend?
And so, did they applaud at the end?
So yeah, so it was an interesting, you know, meetup afterwards. You know, afterwards I come down and I've got like stage makeup on, and it's, you know, it when you meet a stage actor right after the show, like they don't look the same.
Hey Jensen, can we just do something real quick? Pretend you're you, and I'm going to be one of your buddies coming up from the baseball team.
All right.
Ready? Here we go.
Hey guys.
Hey man.
What'd you think?
What's on your face, man?
Oh, that's that.
You got something on your face.
Yeah, no. It's like clown makeup, you know.
You wear makeup?
Because the light.
What?
Well, it's more just like it's paint. It's like paint. It's like theater paint.
Oh.
Yeah. What'd you guys think?
Oh, I don't know, man. You sing. That's kind of weird.
Yeah.
You never sang on the baseball field or nothing.
No. Not between chewing sunflower seeds and dipping in the outfield. No, it was.
Should we get separate locker rooms? You know, probably back then it was probably a little weird.
You're not far off. But however, it was.
But they liked you. You were good. They were like, you're.
Yeah, they. It was a reluctant kind of applaud. Like I came up and they were like, they didn't want to look at me in the eye. They were like, man, that was awesome. Nice job, man.
Looking down. Hey man, you were great.
Yeah,
man.
Eyes down, not making eye contact, just telling me like, man, that was really good, man. I didn't know you could do that. That's cool. All right, well, we're gonna go in the parking lot and crush a six pack.
Are you coming with us? Hell yeah, I am.
Yeah.
Hey, how
about you wipe that? Why don't you wipe that crap off your face and come meet us for some Coors?
Did you? Maria had to be a hard song to sing.
It was a very difficult song, and I was working with the girl who played Maria. Her name was Kendra Ware, and she was a like all state, all national, like choir genius. And she was like this phenom. And I'm like, great. You're going to put the jock with the like songbird over here. And she's going to make me look like a moron. And I remember when we first started rehearsals, like she came up to me and she was like, look, I'm not real comfortable with the whole acting and reciting lines and like the movement and stuff. She's like, I just stand there and sing. Can you kind of give me some, can you give me a little help with like that aspect? I'm like, if you can help me sing. So we did, we worked together and she kind of gave me some pointers and I helped her out with the blocking and all that kind of stuff.
Can you still hit that note? The most beautiful sound I ever heard. That last one.
Oh dude, I couldn't hit it that night. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but Rob, you know what happens?
Maria.
That was kind of it. I mean, we were kind of there. It's such a hard note. Grab your balls, buddy.
That was a hard song to sing, man. And we were singing it.
I love watching your success. And I love watching your success because to me, you've always been a great guy. You've always been some guy who shows up to set, whether it's showing up to set and you're prepared and you're fun and you're just one of the guys. You're just a dude. You're just, you have a big heart. You know what's right. So, you know, Tom and I were always like, you know, I remember hearing Supernatural is going off to do Supernatural. And we're like, well, what's that? You just don't know. And then when we started to see, wow, good for him. And Jared, because I knew Jared too a little bit. And,
yeah.
You know, it was just seeing good guys do well. And that's always nice, you know?
Oh, that's and thank you for the compliment. That's very nice. I mean, you guys were certainly some folks that I look to for guidance in that regard and just also somebody that I look to for inspiration on. Like, I don't know that I've ever worked on a set that was more entertained by a single person than by you walking on set. I'll never forget the time we walked on set and we did the entire blocking musically. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
You and I were like in the trailer and we were playing guitar and you were, they were like, hey guys, you know, it's that they're ready for blocking. And it was like your home set. I don't know. I forget what the name of that set was. And you were like
Luther Mansion.
That's it. It was a Luther Mansion. And you were like, we were right in the middle of the song. He's like, wait, I'm not that way. We're just finished. You know what? Screw it. Let's just bring this on set and we'll figure it out. And you kept those like three or four chord progression going. And then we ended up doing all the dialogue musically and people couldn't work for like an hour because they were trying to calm themselves down from the laughter.
Cause your name was Teague, right? Your last name was Teague, Jason Teague.
Yeah.
Jason, I think you should work for me. Jason, I am the mastermind criminal of all time. Mr. Luther. We're idiots.
Oh man, it is. And then there's a couple of other folks in there that they couldn't sing or they didn't want to sing or they weren't going to jump on the rosy bandwagon.
They weren't.
And you just plowed right through and could have cared less. And
I wish I still had that sort of attitude. I mean,
dude, you're legend. I mean, I still work in Vancouver and there's still guys that worked like the first several seasons of Smallville that are on Supernatural and have been for many, many years. And they still talk about, you know, when Rosie would roll onto set or some joke you did or when you decided to moon the crew 72 times in a day or whatever it was.
Were your parents always like so supportive? Were they always like, you want to act? Act. You want to play sports? Play sports. We love whatever you want to do, or they want you to do something.
Yeah, they were supportive on kind of all fronts. And I think it's very obvious when you look at my sister and my brother, the three of us are wildly different. You know, my brother went and was more studious and less of a social presence. And he was a drummer on the drum line and he went to, you know, a college and played in the marching band. And he was just kind of surrounded himself with a lot of much more different people, wasn't an athlete. And then I came up through the ranks and cut a wide swath as far as being socially promiscuous and doing things to where my sister kind of had a nice, easy stroll in the park. But she kept it. She kept it between the lines really well too. My brother and my sister were, I think, gave my mother and father a lot less of a headache than I did. I was the middle child.
What did you do that was so? Were you always getting in trouble? Did you get arrested ever?
Once, and then there was a lot of tomfoolery that wasn't that I'm sure if they'd known about, which some of it they did, some of it they never found out.
Well, what did
you
do to go to jail?
Oh man, this is not a. I didn't go to jail, but I was. We went out, snuck out of the house, went out with some buddies, and we decided to shoot up some
heroin.
No.
I know, not heroin.
We were getting into paintball at this time.
Oh yeah,
and we decided to grab our guns and go for a spree around the neighborhood, and that ended up in a bit of a high speed car chase on the highway with about 10 cops.
And they didn't arrest you?
Well, they arrested me until they figured out that it was not a real firearm, that it was a paintball gun, and then they held me there while they held me there on the side of the highway in cuffs until my dad came and picked me up.
Did he beat your ass?
He was not happy.
Well, were your parents, did your dad ever give you a smack in the ass? Was he kind of a dad, like a Texas dad? It was like, yeah, you ain't that shit. Go get my belt.
Go pick out a belt. Yeah.
See, my smart ass would have got like a little girly belt and like bought it for him and put it up there.
No, see, that's what you think. Like that, the little one
they
hurts
more
because it's like a whip. Oh yeah. No, I wanted the big thick, you know, the big wide belt. I didn't even get my mom's, you know, her 70s wide belt. Cause that one, get hit with a magazine as opposed to a whip.
Did you ever try standing up to your dad?
No.
Was he a big dude? How big's your dad?
He's my size. He was 6 feet, 200 pounds, but he also never put me in a position where I needed to stand up for myself like that. He was right.
He was right.
Yeah. Yeah. He would never act out in a way where I was like, this is injustice and I'm going to stand up to him. He's a great guy. He's a good
guy. You guys drink beers together?
No, he's not he doesn't drink. He's a pretty conservative fella, but there's a lot of laugh. a lot of laughter in my family. He was a pretty funny guy.
With all the work you do, man, though, do you feel like you need a couple beers after work to just let go and kind of go to sleep? Do you feel
no?
Like, are you not a drinker? Much of a drinker?
No, not a couple of beers. More like a couple of bottles of whiskey will probably do the trick.
Come on, that's bullshit. You couldn't drink a whole bottle of whiskey, could you?
Probably.
You probably could.
Probably.
But are you the kind of guy who's
I wouldn't try it. Yeah, you know, I'm certainly like a come home and you know, pour a couple of fingers and read my script for the next day and then go to sleep.
How fast are you at learning lines?
At this point, I'll read what I need to learn for tomorrow, the day before or the night before. And then the next morning I'll get up and I'll read through it in the hair makeup trailer. And then if it's extensive dialogue, I'll run it a few times, maybe by myself or with whoever I'm working. If it's with Jared, I'll run it with Jared. If it's with Misha, we'll get together and we'll run it a few times. But for the most part, that's it. If it's a fairly simple scene, a page scene or whatever like that, I won't even have the lines memorized. I just understand the blocking and understand what needs to be said. And the lines just kind of come.
Really?
Yeah.
Was there a part or a time on the show where the first few seasons were like you would really learn the lines inside out and really like, you know, spend more time on them and not the day before, but try to learn the script in advance and, you know, work yourself to the bone or like, this is not working for me?
No, Jared will be, he does that. He reads the script a dozen times and he goes over it and over it and I guess works out what he wants to do. I will read it once and then just trust my instincts.
But so you don't have to have it word by word. If it's like a little all over, it's okay. As long as it makes sense and it's articulate.
Yeah. The writers aren't sticklers necessarily like comedic writers where it's like, oh no, that says do not. That doesn't say don't. We'll change things. We'll massage dialogue to maybe make it a little bit more conversational, maybe make it a little bit more character driven,
right.
Maybe make it make sense to, I mean, there's been multiple times in the script where it literally says in the stage direction and then just whatever Jensen wants to say here.
Does it really say that?
Yeah.
I love that. That's great.
Yeah, they'll just literally just throw it to me and be like, and then what else, if he's got anything else, then just have him throw that in.
Is there anything you've made up over the years that's become kind of a trademark Jensen Ackles, like that you just know that fans know that you do something that you kind of added and then that became a thing?
From the pilot episode, there was a line that Kripke had written where the car gets stolen, essentially, and a ghost like possesses the car. But we get it back, and then I say the line, son of a bitch. And I don't think it was written to be more than just a begrudgingly like, son of a bitch, you know, an exasperated kind of a thing.
Right.
And I like yelled it out loud like I wanted someone to hear me. You know, I was like, son of a bitch!
Was it unexpected? They didn't expect you to do that?
And now that's like the catchphrase and in like so many different facets, you know, whether it's yelling, whether it's,
do you ever sign that? Do you ever sign son of a bitch for people?
I just put SOB.
You put SOB. They're like, can you spell that out, please? I don't know.
Yeah.
That
can you put son of a bitch on there? Yeah, sure. SOB. There you go.
So you said like the show was sort of in a bubble for many years of not getting like, you know, we don't know if we're going to get picked up. They're kind of like this. And I know that studios kind of F with actors, you know, they kind of like, you know, we're going to say it's not doing that great to keep them on their toes, so they don't want to renegotiate. When was it you were like, we're renegotiating?
Like season 4 or 5, when the writer creator was like, I'm out. I had 5 years planned out. That's the 5 I'm going to give you. I'm moving on. And when they were like, okay, great. Well, that's fine. We'll just find somebody to come in and keep it going because this isn't going anywhere. That's when I was like, oh, shit.
You're like, okay, that was the time. And were you guys boys, like you and Jared, let's go in together?
Oh, as far as like negotiating stuff?
More power with two and numbers?
Yeah, I mean, since season 2.
You guys have been, and everything, it's you two.
We've been on the same page, yeah.
That's it. This is what I think we should ask for. This is what I think we should. And did there come a time you're like, you know, I can't work this hard as this much for this many episodes a year. And I miss my family. I miss all these things. I want to have some kind of like a modicum of life or whatever that is. And did you think, you know what, I'm not working on Fridays, or I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to get these, you know, is there something in there?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's, you know, when you're working, especially when you're working out of state, out of country, which, you know, this is something that you're very familiar with and that you dealt with, you know, you put your life on hold intensely. And when your life continues to go and to grow outside of the show, like when you find a mate and you get married and you start a family and you have children, and then there's, you know, your extended family and your friends and all these people that you really never see because you're in a different state or in a different city, you know, working 12 to 14 hours a day, Monday through Friday. And then you're exhausted by the weekend and it's all about recovery so you can turn around and do it again on Monday. That schedule is, you know, only tenable for so long. And then you start to have to tell the writers, hey, I need a little bit of relief here. Can you bring in some other characters to shoulder some of this weight? So they did. And, you know, they started bringing in some other characters. Misha came in season four. You know, they brought Mark Shepard in. They brought a few other kind of guest cast that turned into full time cast. That gave us a little bit of leeway. You know, at this time, we were still trying to up our you know, still trying to get money and still trying to negotiate that stuff. But eventually it got to a point, and this was years ago, it got to a point where, like, it wasn't about the money. They paid us fine. Like, they were compensating us for our work, and we were fine with that. It was about the quality of life. And so that's when we started, like, really asking for
a plane,
longer vacations, longer weekends, requested 4 or 5 day weekends, that kind of stuff. And they did it. And they were like, you know what, we'll make that happen. But at the same time, we didn't want to be like, you know, we're not going to work on Fridays, we're not going to work on Mondays, we're going to, you know, we only want to work 10-hour days or something like that. If Jared and I did something like that and put that contractual, it would have made the show suffer. I think he and I both would never want to risk the quality of the show declining for personal reasons. And I think that was, you know, that's one of the many things that weighed into the decision that a lot of us had about moving on, was that we don't want that to become a rub. We don't want to not feel like we want to be there. I wanted to make sure that I spent time with my family. My family knew I loved them, but I also wanted to spend enough quality time with the show and do what's right by that, because it's very important. They're both very important to me, and I want to give them equal energy and time and all that stuff. And it's tough. It's been a difficult balance the past couple of years.
How tired have you been to the point where you're like, I can't do this? Have you ever been like, I just can't maintain this sort of work schedule? I can't. I just can't physically and mentally do this.
No. I don't know why. I feel like I have made a commitment to the show. Yes, I'm under contract, and I could, you know, be in legal problems if I decided just to throw in the towel and not show up. But I would never, it goes beyond that for me. It goes beyond, I could right now list a dozen to two dozen names that I work with, no matter how tired they are. And they're showing up because they've got mouths to feed. They're showing up when they're tired or when they're exhausted because they have to. I don't have to, but if they're doing it, they can't show up if I'm not there. And I don't want to be the one responsible for them not getting a decent paycheck that week.
I think my point really was not like that you didn't want to, but the point where I was just like, you were just physically like, can I, in your mind, like, I'm so fucking tired. I can't talk to my wife tonight. I can't fly back to see my kids this week. And I don't have the strength right now. Have you ever been that tired, or are you, that's what more of what I'm saying.
Yeah, I have been that tired, but I do it anyway.
You push through it. Do you work out? How do you do it? Do you consistently every day, hey, if I'm going to do this, my body's got to be in great shape. My mind's got to be in great shape. I've got to eat really well. How do you prepare for something like this? You can't really let yourself go.
No, you can't. And I'm not as good about that as Jared is. You know, he is one of those guys. He's a regimented. He's like, I have to get up and jog 5 miles a day or I don't function. I'm like, I would rather the extra hour and a half of sleep. So that's me. I take a lot of naps now.
I love my naps. Rob's already, what are you, 20?
30.
He's got a kid. He's, you know, you nap, don't you?
No.
You don't nap?
No, that's not, if, when I'm home, no time for naps. But when I'm on set, nap time.
Nap sitting?
In fact, Jared, Jared and I, we have certainly evolved over the years in the fact that when we used to go to lunch, if we had a long day or we had a long week, we were working back to back 14ers, we would go to lunch and it'd be like, you know, come on over to the trailer. Let's run some lines or hey, let's go play some ping pong or let's shoot some hoops. Let's watch this special that's on right now or whatever. We'd hang out and we just kind of relax. And like lunch was more of just like a social hour. I would say 40 to 55% of the time over the past like two seasons, when they call lunch, he and I look at each other and we go sleep contest, and we go and literally we go straight to our trailers, shut the door, turn the lights out, and immediately just zone out.
They know not to bother you. You're out.
They just, yeah, we had signs that were made up when both of our children were very small and they'd come to visit. And it just says baby is sleeping on like a big post. It looks like a stop sign.
And it's always there. The baby is always sleeping.
And our kids are now not babies anymore. But that sign still gets put out in front of our trailers every lunch hour. The babies are sleeping.
Oh, my God.
It is, man. And there's a time, you know, there are times when it is exhausting or when I've pushed myself too much and I'm really tired or shit, really hungover, whatever it is. And it's just like, you figure it out, you know, you ask for help from the right people and you do what you need to do to get through it.
How long are you going to take when they say, I asked Misha this, all right, first of all, do you think you're going to break down completely when you're wrapped for good? And B, can you honestly say like, I am going to do nothing for a good year at least?
No. I think I work harder when I'm home than I do when I'm on set.
Doing what? Like with family stuff or?
Oh yeah. My wife and I have been in the garage all morning, like rearranging and like putting stuff for storage and giving stuff to Goodwill. And like,
I'm at work. Hey, let's I'm at work, like film. Like you want to just take a year off and just be with the family or can you not do that?
No, but that's another thing too, is I love to work. Like I love being on set. I love the camaraderie. I love the collaboration. I love turning what's on the page into something visual. You know, I love the whole thing, man. I love walking on set and going to the caterers in the morning and getting breakfast and saying good morning to everybody and getting coffee and sitting down with the hair and makeup ladies and, you know, listening to them gossip about whatever it is they're gossiping about. It's just the whole thing going on set, figuring out how to put this puzzle together that is a script. I love that. You know, I'm going back. We start in a few weeks, and I'm directing the first episode. And you know, I always say that as a director, you're essentially the captain of the problem solving squad, and your script is your problem, and you have to solve it. And I just love that kind of collaborative problem solving environment that is working on set.
I mean, how do you go from like, you know, because I've directed many times before and I think, you know, you're on set and you're like the lead guy, you and Jared, and now you're going to direct every scene and then you're going to direct yourself and then you have another 19 episodes to do after that and you're cross shooting, you're probably doing stuff from episode two. So it's like, I'm like, holy shit, are you sure you want to go and direct? Do you ever be like, this is a lot. Why am I doing this to myself?
Yeah, I will say it is, you know, the season itself, I've always compared that to like running a marathon. Like you got to pace yourself because it's a lot of work and it's, you know, you can't burn out quick because like you said, you just get to a point of exhaustion where you just can't do it any longer. You know, luckily he and I and the rest of the crew have been doing it for enough years to where we know how to pace ourselves properly. But what most people don't anticipate, and I've done it now, this would be my sixth time, is that directing is essentially like starting a marathon with sprinting the first 2 miles. Cause there's so much to think about. It's such a mentally like exhaustive process of, you know, going through every single page and every single, you know, line and figuring out how you're going to shoot that from a visual standpoint. And then you've got to go, okay, this is how I want to do that. What are the departments? Who are the people that I need to talk to in order to facilitate that? And then you got to break that down. And then you've got to, you know, then you've got to convince the actors to do what you want them to do.
And this is all pre-production.
And this is all pre-production. This is before even like stepping foot on stage.
Right.
And then inevitably you step on stage and the best laid plans, they will go to shit. And you will walk on set and you will be like, wait a second, that wall doesn't move. I thought we talked about that in pre-production. And someone's like, no, you talked about that wall. Like, no, it was that.
You're right. It was that wall.
So that wall doesn't move. No, that one does.
Which one?
Well, that completely changes everything about the whole structure of the scene. And now we can't have the person coming through that window. Mm. And now if it's through that, then you have, 80 sets of eyes just staring at you. Go,
what next?
What you going to do about it?
Yeah. Huh? What do you do now? Make a face.
Yeah. What's going to be now, clown boy? and this is when I've seen directors succeed or fail. Is how they handle that moment. And every director is going to feel that moment. They may not feel it, on our show, but if
it's a daunting task. It is. I've been there in that moment where like, hey, what do we do now? There was one time when I was doing something, we had to like, all of a sudden we were on sticks, which means it's just like you're on a tripod, if you will, and you're like filming, but you're not moving the camera handheld. I'm telling that for the audience. I know you know that, but like, but it's started to rain. And we were like, we'll never get this done. So we're going handheld and we're going to block shoot, which means we're going to shoot all the scenes in a row in that direction and then shoot them this direction. My mind does not work like that. And I'm creative, right? And I'll come up with stuff and I know how to do but it's more linear. And the AD looked at me. And I'll never forget this. This is day 14 of 18. And it was going so well until that moment on this movie. And she looked at me. She goes, so what do you want to do? For the first time ever in my life, I had nothing to say. She looked at me and she goes, okay. And she took over. She literally, for that moment, took over and goes, all right, we're going to go this way. Here's what we're going to do. Because she knows that. And I felt like an idiot, but I was like, I just didn't know what to do. I needed more time than right that second. I'm not Stanley Kubrick, who gets to do 100 takes or something. We got to shoot 110 pages in like 17 days. And for this moment, I was like, I don't know what the best idea is. So we had to have some meetings where I'm like, I had to defer to the people who really know what they're doing, like the DP who's done a lot of movies, who's the AD who's worked on 20 movies, who's, and I said, you know what? I nailed it a lot of times, but there's some times where I felt like an idiot.
Yeah, I need help and I need you guys to help me.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of times when, like you said earlier, how you've as a director, you've got to direct everybody else, but you also have to direct yourself. And we don't have time. I mean, there's just no time to sit and watch playback all day long. Sure, you can do that, but you're not gonna get your days. And we pack so much filming into a 12-hour day, there's no time for that kind of like, let's him and haw about, whether that angle was good or whether that light was good or whether no. I'll do a scene. If I'm in the scene, I will do the take. If it felt good, I'll look at my camera operator and be like, yeah, cause he's been watching me for 15 years. I'll be like, we good. He's like, it was all there. I look at my DP and I'm like, lighting, performance, everything. He's like, yep,
that's it.
AD's like, any hiccups? Nope. Moving on.
Trust. You got to trust. Because the last thing you want to do is one of those fucking actors who are like, let me just go see myself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Can I just see how I did. It looked? No, you can't.
Sit down, clown face.
Sit down. You know what? There was, you were telling a story a minute ago with, we're on sticks and like things were happening and weather and stuff.
Yeah.
So it reminds me of a story I was having a Supernatural one time. We were shooting down on a beach. It was a very rocky beach. It was at night. Like a boat comes in and it goes up onto the beach and the camera's on sticks on the beach and it's shooting at us standing like it. Basically the waves are kind of crashing against our ankles and stuff. And we're having this conversation and the tide is starting to come in and we're not getting the shot and the tide keeps coming in and they keep having to pick up the camera on the tripod and bring it back. And eventually it gets to a point where it's like the end of the scene and we've got it. But the director yells out from the tent. He's like, give me a push in. And for the audience, that's where the camera slowly moves into the actor. And it's a, it kind of adds a little dramatic flair. Oh, no. It's a nice accent, right?
Right.
Well, they're running out of beach and the water's now like really getting high and there's no time to lay track. And so I just say, I'm like, you know, guys, like the camera guys are like, we don't have your track. We can't lay track. You know, it's, we're running out of time. The water's coming up on the thing. It's like, and I'm like, I got it. Just roll. And we roll. And I'm not kidding.
You moved up.
I just do this. I go.
You put, so you literally, you bent into the picture.
I spread my legs out. And then I just slowly moved while looking at the other actor. And just slowly went straight towards camera.
You created a push-in.
Yeah.
And the camera stayed where it was, and you slowly moved into the camera.
I slowly moved into the camera.
When they said cut, did they applaud you?
The crew did. The director was like, thank you!
We could have got that, you schmuck!
Yeah.
Dude, that is genius. Oh, I wish that was... Yeah. You have that? You had to get that piece of film.
Oh, yeah. No, they use it. That's And now we'll just do it all the time. And the director's like, what are you doing? Why are you pushing in? I didn't ask for the push in. The camera guys are like, we're on sticks. That's the actors being assholes.
That is gorgeous. Oh, yeah. My God. And the other question was, don't think I forgot, is like, how do you feel when you look at Jared for the last time or Misha for the last time? And I know it's not the last time, but the last time you're doing the
show. Oh, you were asking about the, yeah.
How do you think you're going to feel? Do you think you'll be able to just keep it together?
I don't know, man. I think for me, it's not going to be like, you know, they're going to be like, and that's a series wrap on Supernatural. And I'm going to be like, I might. But for me, I think it's going to come in little waves leading up to the end. You know, it's going to come in little moments where I'm like, that's going to be the last time I do that. Or that's going to be the last time I sit down and read a script.
This is the last time I act with Misha. This is the last time I act with Jared. This is the last time I say goodbye to my makeup artist, whatever that is.
Right. Whatever those little moments are, and this season is going to be full of them. That's the last holiday party we're going to have.
You could also do this, Jensen. I could just see right now. Oh my God, this is the last first shot from a season I'll do. Oh my God, yeah. This is the last first Saturday I'll have off after the first.
Jared's week. Already started. Jared's like, this is the last hiatus we're gonna have.
But he's not serious.
I'm like, we're oh yes. He was like, just think, man. This is our last hiatus.
And you're like, yeah, dude, yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I'm aware.
We've had 15 of them.
People, yeah, we've had 15. I think we're good. Yeah, that's more summer breaks than you experienced while going to school. So we're okay. But I do remember the last season or the last episode of this last season, and like, you know, Jared kind of got a little emotional. He's like, this is the last time we're gonna break for hiatus, and then everybody's like, what's it going to be like when it's over? And I'm like, people, we have a year left. All year. It's not like we gave our 2 weeks notice. We gave our 12-month notice.
We have a year.
A year. Can we save this for January?
And they're like, God, Clownface is such a dick. Dude, this has been a real treat, man. I mean, I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. You know, another thing that's cool is, you know, we both did Jason Mann's album Cover with Friends. Yeah. And we both did a song on that. I always love hearing your voice. And Jason just produced. I know Jason Mann's a good buddy. That's how we met, I think, through Jason. No. I met Jason through you. Right. We were kind of playing guitar one day and up in.
Although Jason's one of those guys, anybody I've ever introduced him to, they're always like, I want to be friends with him. I'm like, yeah, I know. He's good.
And he produced our album, Left on Laurels album, so which is coming out, and he's just extraordinary. He's such a calm, patient, and I had never been in the studio and recording these songs, and he makes you feel so comfortable, right?
He's a Yoda.
He really is. Yeah. So it's been fun touring with him in Germany, and I know a lot of the Supernatural fans know Jason and fan of his.
Oh, yeah.
And but look, man, I'm so grateful for this time with you, and you know, you I always consider you a friend, and I know how busy you are, but you know, once this season's over, the next season, I'll probably hopefully see you once in a blue moon.
Well, I know you will, because I'm gonna have to start coming back out to LA and looking for a job.
You got a place to stay if you need one.
Well, there you go. As long as it has a microphone like that and nothing but hockey jerseys hanging in there.
Yeah, a lot of hockey jerseys. I got Freddy Krueger up there, and I got, dude, thank you for allowing me to be inside of you, Jensen Ackles. You're buddy, a mensch.
It's been a joy and a pleasure.
Yeah, I'd say this is probably your best interview you've ever done.
It's certainly one of the interviews I've done.
Rob didn't get it at first. Yeah, it took him an extra second. He just gave you. Hey, give love to Daniil and the family. And
I will.
I'll try to get up to Vancouver and see you before it's all over. I love you, buddy.
I love you too, Rob.
That was Jensen Ackles. Guys, hey, thanks for listening to the episode today. As promised, I told you I'd play a song every episode until the album's done of our new album, Left on Laurel, Saved by the Ground. Today, right now, you can go to the iTunes store. It's available on all platforms. You can buy the songs, listen to it. Merch is on Inside of You store. Our handle, Left on Laurel, the whole band, tweet us. We'll tweet you back. We love talking to you. Here is track four on the album, the debut album. This is called Lost. With your eyes wide open.
Somehow, your world is spinning and your life's in peril. You're breaking down. And how, you were blind and now you see in double. Saved by the ground. You lost, with your eyes wide open. Lost, with your eyes wide open.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.